The recordings are now started. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the 21st GENESO EPDPT meeting taking place on the 30th of October 2018 at 13 UTC. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. We'll be taking attendance by the Adobe Connect room only. If you're therefore only on the telephone, could you please let yourself be known now?
Hi, it's Christina Rosette. I'm waiting for yet another set of updates to download, so as soon as my computer is usable, I will be on Adobe. But in the meantime, I'm just on the phone. Thanks.
Thank you ever so much, Christina. This will be noted. Kavgus Alistair will only also be on the audio for this call, and we have a note that Emily Taylor will be joining the call late. In the meantime, we've received apologies from Ashley Heinemann and Georgia Salentis from the GAC, Yotel Singhis from the NCHG, Leon Sanchez, our ICANN board liaison. They formally assigned Laureen Kappin, Chris Lewis-Evans, Tatiana Tropina as the alternatives for this call and for remaining days of absence. During this period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls until the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment must be formalized by way of a Google assignment form, and the link is available in the agenda part on the right-hand side. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. If you do have modifications to make in the future, please don't hesitate to email the GENESO Secretariat. All documentation and information can be found on the EPDP Wiki space. There's an audio cast and view only Adobe Connect room for non-members to follow the call. Please remember, therefore, to state your names before speaking. All recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. Thank you ever so much, and over to our chair, Kurt Pritt.
Thanks, Natalie, and hi, everyone. I hope you made it back safe and sound, or that you're traveling for enjoyment somewhere. And thanks very much for all the time spent on this at the ICANN meeting while others were seeing the sights. And the agenda calls for a recap of the ICANN meeting, and you were all there. So I don't know how much is necessary. I think on Monday we made some significant and really meaningful progress on purposes A, B, and C, and which are I think the most important. And you know, I think it took us a little bit longer than we expected. So we worked on the purpose itself a lot, and not on the rest of the workbook. So that's why we're sort of saddled with those we've used right now. That was in the Saturday session. On Monday, I think the public session went really well, and I don't know if anybody wants to contribute any feedback that you received, either verbally or written, from others. But I received positive feedback, and one comment really went to why there were no questions right away when we finished, and that was because the audience was really still taking in all the information it was receiving, and the amount of detailed work that occurred. So I think that was a good sign. On the next meeting, which I think was on Wednesday, I think you know, we made some good progress on this on the small group session. So I think there's still a little ways to go there, but that went okay. And then on the Thursday session, I kind of put it on myself that we discussed certain data elements for so long and should have wrangled that. And in fact, I think even before that session, I had talked to, you know, I've had conversations with some people who have recommended that I work a little harder to funnel the discussion. So I'm sure many of you will be happy to hear that. So I'm going to try to do that, to get, you know, one set of comments from everyone on an issue and then stop and pause and see where we are on the issue before going around the table two or three more times. So if I stumble or I'm a little bit clumsy in that, please let me know. So that's the ICANN meeting. Does anybody else have any inputs or comments they want to make about that? So on the face-to-face meeting, I got a lot more feedback on my email than I planned. So, you know, to me personally, you know, January is almost 3 months away, and it seems awfully far, even though it's on the other side of public comment. And what I'm finding out is that people have conflicts all over the place. There's meetings in December, meetings in January. So somebody suggested we do a doodle poll, and we're just settling on the dates for that. And we'll get that out right away about when people are available. And then, you know, we're going to pick the dates when the most people are available. And we plan to have the meeting outside the United States. But other than that, we're going to have it in the cheapest place. So that's I don't have really any further update on the face-to-face planning, but a lot of that is going to happen in the next couple days. Review of outstanding action items. Do we have a list to put up? Is Marika or Caitlin available? I think what we're going to look at is Marika's, essentially Marika's email. Yeah, so Marika or Caitlin, can you talk to this, or would you rather me do that?
Kurt, this is Caitlin. I can speak to it.
Okay, great.
So action item one is completed, as you can note on the document in front of you. Action item two was for each all TDP team members to express their constituency's views or proposed edits to the small team one responses to charter questions and preliminary recommendations. And as you can see, that relevant link is in the document, and it's also posted on the wiki. Similarly, each group was to express their views or propose edits with the revised responses of the small team two charter question responses by Monday, which was yesterday. And each group is to review the latest versions of all of the data elements workbooks and flag any issues that need to be reviewed prior to publication of our initial report by Friday, November 2nd. And I did want to note on all data elements workbooks on the wiki, you can find the clean version, which for your ease of your editing, but also the redline version, which shows all of the edits staff made so that it's clear to you what is new language and what was the original language from the group. Additionally, a document was sent out, I believe it was last Friday or last Thursday, and that was a note about the responsible parties overview. That document is also posted on the wiki, and that's just to confirm that the team agrees with the characterization of controller, processor, et cetera. And all of those are noted in the corresponding data elements workbooks. However, this isolates the responsible party so that it's easier to review. We did want to note, of course, that staff is behind the scenes working on populating the initial report, and so timely review of these items is really critical so that we can get you the draft of the initial report for review before it's published. So thank you, Kurt. Back over to you.
Okay, and I know these items are somewhat tricky to coordinate because we're asking not for individual contributions, but contributions from each group. So that's important. And the degree of the advice is really specific. It's essentially a red line or suggested text. I think that's important too. And as Caitlin noted, the work is being taken out of the workbooks and put into initial report. So we can see what that'll look like, and that's happening right now. So that doesn't mean as we receive input, we won't be able to continue to amend the initial report. But I think it's really important that we get to see what the initial report looks like, because then I think you know, the light bulb will go on with regard to how close or how far we are away. So that's essentially that. Do you want to put the agenda back up? Or is it over here on the right?
Hello, Kurt. Do you hear me, Kurt?
Yeah, I do.
This is Kavuza. I am only on audio bridge just to let you know that I am not connected. I'm just on audio bridge. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kavuza. I think that's, I had another update, but I can't remember what it was, so we're going to let it go. So, this is Milton. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Can everybody hear me? This is Milton Mueller.
Yes, we can.
Okay. So, I just want to let you know that despite the request for extra time, we pretty much have know what we're going to say about small team report number one. So I just thought I would float the basic ideas here, and then we can send in the red line text that we're proposing after it's approved by everybody. But some people were still traveling as of yesterday, so we don't have a formal stamp of approval yet, but it's pretty clear where we want to go with this. So one of the things we wanted to emphasize is that when we talk about the risk of trying to distinguish between legal persons and natural persons, we don't think the main risk has been stated to us, and I think to many of the contracted parties. The main risk, and I quote, is that the difficulty of distinguishing between the two at the point of registration could lead to the unintended publication of the private data of many natural persons. That to us is the main risk, and then there's also the problem of the legal persons who designate natural persons as a contact, but to us that's secondary. The other key change we want to make is that under the recommendation bullet points, currently it reads the distinction between natural persons is useful and necessary for GDPR. This we are quite convinced is not correct. We want to say that the distinction exists under GDPR and some other data protection laws, but there are challenges in making this distinction in the context of domain name registrations, as well as the potential implementation of any new functionality that would apply. So we're proposing a very important change in that recommendation. I'm not sure about how this will play out in our own group, but we are considering deleting entirely the bullet point that starts with following the receipt of the research, the EPDT team will explore in a timely manner how the distinction can be made, because that bullet point basically assumes that we will be requiring registrars to make the distinction, which we're pretty sure is not going to be a consensus recommendation. So those are basically that's our take on small team number one. We can send you a link to our Google Doc, or we can, I guess, try to put it in a Word doc, whatever is more convenient.
Thanks, Milton. I think sending it in either form. Either form will be fine, and I'll just, without opening the discussion on this, I'll note that I remember that James Bledel was tasked with including the risks associated with making that distinction. So if your first item wasn't already included, it will be. And then I don't want to talk about this topic now because we'll wait for everybody's input and then we'll get everybody's input, and then we'll have some sort of relation document. So, Javier,
okay. So, what is the proper method to turn in input? Is it just sort of a overview description like I just gave? Is it a marked up document? Is it on the mailing list? Is it in a Google Doc? What do you propose?
Yeah, so I would email in a red line of the document.
As a Word doc, okay.
Yeah, that'd be fine. You know, include, you know, send it to the whole list and, you know, include your rationale as you described it or fleshed out what your reasoning is. And that's, I'm answering Milton's question, but with everyone, not just understanding what changes are requested, but why will be really helpful for all of us in deliberating over email. All right. So let's go back over here. So the agenda for this meeting is really kind of the Christina Rosette show. So I'm glad she's fully in the Adobe Connect room. The first document to be discussed is Purpose M. So we have two purposes we want to discuss today. Purpose M, which has to do with dispute resolution, and Purpose N, which is a new purpose that was created by to take into account registries with specific domain name registration restrictions. And
Kurt, it's Christina. Can we go ahead and start with Purpose M? And I'm actually going to hand off to Diane because she has had a more recent opportunity to provide her input on the comments that I had circulated. And quite frankly, Purpose M is, I suspect, of much greater interest and value to the IPC and the VC than the contracted parties at this point. So I think it would really only be fair to give her the opportunity to lead. Thanks.
Okay. That'd be fine. And I assume you were saying Emma's and Mickey. So.
Correct.
And so I just want to point out some of the issues here. One is whether we wanted to include dispute resolution processes on that aren't UDRP and URS, and so that was one issue for us to decide. And I went over these this morning and went over some of the other issues, but the other issues had to do with legal bases, I think, for these. So those are some of the primary issues. But Diane, do you want to go ahead? And so I am not looking at the Adobe room anymore. But okay, there it is. There's the document. But you know, I choose to look at it full size on my laptop. So Diane, welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Kurt. Could you hear me?
Hi, Diane.
Hi. How are you? I am pleased to discuss this. I circulated it just recently, my update to the group, and Christina, unfortunately, that I am trying to throw her under the bus in her words, but certainly that would never be my intention. We didn't have the opportunity to meet at the ICANN meeting, which was unfortunate, to no one's fault, for scheduling reasons. And since then, she circulated her document without first consulting me, which is fine. We're all busy. And then I only got it late yesterday and had the obligation to circulate it to my team. I only made very minor changes. So, in fact, I certainly am not looking to throw her under the bus. We are in alignment on most of the issues, and I've just made minor additions. So, I'm pleased to go over those and work with Christina together to explain them to the group. And so happy to do that. I know that Marika is trying to put something up. Marika, is it possible to make it a little bigger?
Diane, this is Marika. You can zoom in yourself, everyone can, by using the plus, you can make it a bigger or smaller as needed. And this is the version that you circulated, so it should have your comments as well in addition to the ones Christina provided.
Okay, so Christina, feel free to jump in at any time to collectively be able to explain the changes. We have decided that we would use the wording coordinate, operationalize, and facilitate policies for resolution of disputes regarding and relating to the registration of domain names. There was the desire to put in the clarity of the wording as opposed to the use of such domain names for data protection purposes, and we're fine with that. And we added the additional dispute resolution mechanisms that were not originally listed because we discussed the fact that there really was no basis for not listing those, and they're useful mechanisms that should be included. So that's how we came up with this proposed purpose description. And we also added the wording for future developed domain name registrations relating to dispute procedures. So we feel that this is a reasonable purpose that covers all bases. Christina, would you like to add any comments on that?
No.
Okay, good. So, and then basically for the purposes based upon the ICANN contracts, we specifically went through identifying the basis under the lawful processing under 6.1b with respect to URS and UDRB for registrars, because we went through the actual breakdown of what technically happens, and Christina was quite helpful in being able to articulate that in breaking down the purposes in relation to 6.1b separately from 6.1f when it comes to RDDRP and PDDRP. And so that's why there's the different distinction of those lawful bases. Then I simply added the need for, right now, ICANN.org has in place with the UDRP and URS providers only MOUs, as Barry described, and if you look online, and we feel that in relation to data protection, modern data protection laws, that needs to be updated for purposes of the security of any personal data that's transferred, and so that there should be a legal recommendation that's made in relation to this purpose to the creation and implementation of data protection agreements, as well as model clauses within a more traditional construct of a contract in relation to regular data protection procedures and under most data protection laws. So that was a legal recommendation that I then added for the end of this document that had been brought up before. That's basically it. I mean, we haven't gone into, we certainly don't think that this is in violations of ICANN's bylaws. It's part of the mission statement in relation to G1 and G2 and to support the resolution of disputes regarding the registration of domain names. And we believe that there are picket fence considerations, which are supported, in fact, in relation to both the resolution of disputes relating to this purpose, as well as what I just added for specificity and clarity, is that to make this a cohesive document, is that the purpose and the processing, any processing as noted, is in the collection transmission when you go to the breakdown of the data elements by the different parties respectively, that that's also within PIC defense considerations for the different data elements that are specifically identified. And that's it. I mean, and then we, I think very appropriately and precisely went into the lawfulness of processing tests by breaking it down of the different roles of the collection by the registrars as the processor under 6.1b, ICANN as a controller for 6.1f purposes, and then the collection of the registration data within the DDRP is different from the transmission of that data, and then the transmission of the data in relation to UDRP, URS, and the two-way mechanisms, and changing the roles appropriately. So that's basically it. If there's anything else that Christina wants to add, I think that would be super.
Not necessarily. I think the only question that I wanted to flesh out, and I think it's really a question more directed to staff, is that the text that was included in response to question number one, the purpose rationale, and I apologize, now I'm having issues getting to the right place. There's a notation in the last line, however, it was determined that these RPMs do not involve registration data, and I was just hoping that whoever added that statement could provide some clarity as the source of the underlying information, because Diane and I had come to the opposite conclusion.
Yeah, thank you for raising that. I didn't know how to address that either.
Hi, this is Kurt. Barry's on the call, but I think he's muted because he's in a place where he can't really talk. I'm going to call on Amr to, if you have a response to this question. If you don't, I'll put you up. If you think there is personal data involved, maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. No, I just really wanted to sort of repeat the, or sort of say that I have a similar question, because I'm not sure how the PDRP and the RDRP include personal data within their own processes. So I'm not certain and why they're included here. I can see why the UDRP and URS might involve process of of registration data, and that its disclosure may be necessary to, for example, the dispute resolution providers. But in terms of the PDR, the post-delegation dispute resolution process, and the RDRP, I don't really understand why they're relevant to this purpose at all. So if someone would clarify that, I'd be grateful. Thank you.
I'm happy to take a stab at that. Unless someone else would rather.
This
is Christina.
Thanks.
Sure. So starting with the RDRP, and so apologies for the typo, that is intended to cover disputes where a community-based new GTLD registry operator deviates or is alleged to be deviating from the registration restrictions that are contained in its registration agreement. And so, as a practical matter, the analysis that Diane and I, basically our view was that if a complainant is going to allege that, for example, a community-based registry is not following its, for example, registration restrictions, you know, only members of the particular community can register domain names in that TLD, that as a practical matter, you would need access, you know, that registration data then becomes relevant, because how else are you going to know one way or the other? That kind of is a very simplified version of it. With regard to the PDDRP, essentially the same thought, namely, if the complaining party is alleging that the registry itself is engaging in, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing, kind of systemic trademark abuse through the registration of domain names in its TLDs, you will need to have, you know, either the complainant will need to have access to that registration data to prove it, and conversely, we anticipated that the registry operator would need access to that data to refute it. So that, at a very high level, the perspective that we were taking and looking at it.
Thanks, Christina. This is Amr again. A follow-up question, if I may. That's really helpful. In the case of the RRDRP, would you mind explaining what data elements would be helpful?
I don't think it's going to be any different data elements. I think you would want to know the registered name holder's name. And I guess I don't know if any of the geos are also communities, but to the extent that they are and have that formal status and have Spec 12 in their agreement, you know, the data about kind of the city and country or whatever the particular element is, to the extent that it's being captured. But it wouldn't be any other data elements other than those that we had already flagged for collection in connection with purpose A. At least I wouldn't expect it. But if there's someone here on the call, and particularly ICANN staff, that's got more background on this, then by all means, please feel free to jump in.
I've been talking for quite some time to myself, so I think ICANN's going to provide some additional written clarification. I've been chatting with them on Skype, but, you know, reading Thomas's explanation here and listening to Christine, it seems like for the purpose of the initial report, I'm going to leave it in and have someone take it out and not Margie.
Thank you. This is Margie. On a separate point, Christina raised a good point that I don't see as part of the processing here disclosure to the complainant for these resolution procedures. And so we're talking about in here, it looks like that you're talking about data from the registrar to the registry and to the provider, but there's the other aspect, which is to the complainant.
So, if no one has a response to this, we had, you know, Margie, you brought this up before, and so I've you know, we've all taken it on board, and so I brought it, concerned about it too. I brought it up in amongst ourselves yesterday in a discussion. So, Caitlin and Marika might provide an explanation for you. So let's see. Marika, your hand is up.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. This is Marika. I actually had my hand up previously and to point people to the response that ICANN.org provided previously in relation to the question as to why these registry dispute resolution procedures were not included in the temporary specification. I've copied that in that language in the chat. And as I understand, but you know, Dan and Tran can correct me if I'm wrong, and it's mainly to do with the fact that in the registry dispute resolution procedures, it's registries who are the complainant versus URS and UDRP, where it's individual registrants that that are involved. So that was one of the underlying reasons. You know, if there are any follow-up questions or any clarifications that are needed, it would be really helpful if the team could specify what they're looking for. And I know Trang has posted in the chat as well, as that will make it easier for us to go back and get you the information that you need. In relation to Margie's question, if I understood correctly, Margie's asking about disclosure to the complainant. I'm definitely not an expert in the UDRP and happily defer to someone else, but as I understand it, that is information that is currently not disclosed either to the complainant, but it's actually the provider that obtains that information and then provides that to the complainant. So would that be a change to the way, you know, UDRP and URS are currently managed and handled? So maybe Margie could specify her specific question as well as how that may differ from what current requirements are, so people may further discuss that.
Yeah. So Margie, could you just, with that elaboration, just ask the question in the exact same way? And I'm going to ask Caitlin. Caitlin has looked at thousands of UDRP cases in her prior life at WIPO, so I think she might be helpful. But could you just repeat the question in the exact same way?
Yeah, sure. I was pointing out that the table doesn't talk about disclosure to the complainant. And to address Marika's concern, there's a distinction between what happened before May 25th and what happened after May 25th. And before May 25th, the complainant would have access to the data to be able to identify the domain names that are to be included in the UDRP. And so so that process is essentially broken now under the temporary spec, because we don't have the ability to do the correlation that we did in the past. And so what's happening now since May 25th is that you have to draft a complaint, which is pretty generic because you don't have the data that's available to support the bad faith allegations that you need to make to submit a UDRP, and then you get the data back from the UDRP provider after you've filed a complaint, but you don't have the ability to really pull in other domain names since you don't have the correlation data. And so what we're asking for is to be able to get that data before the complaint is filed, not after.
So, Margie, this is Caitlin Tuber again from ICANN.org speaking. And I just wanted to I'm trying to understand the problem better, and I'm wondering if there is any difference in pre-May 25th land when it came filing a complaint against a proxy, proxy service or data that was shielded. Because my understanding, which may be incorrect, so please correct me if I'm wrong, is that even in a pre-GDPR world, if the complainant filed a UDRP complaint against a proxy service or for a domain name that was utilizing privacy or proxy services, the registrar would provide that underlying data to the provider, who would then provide it to the complainant, who could then amend its complaint. Were you able to get that sort of correlating data with privacy proxy cases in a pre-GDPR world? Because it seems analogous to me, but maybe I'm missing something. Thank you.
Well, it depends on each provider, right? So you could either get the data from the in a privacy proxy after you file, or a registrar might provide it beforehand, depending upon what the what their policies are. And so I look at this as different from, you know, obviously the privacy proxy rules are still the same, right? And so if I was looking at this as being different from the privacy proxy rules, and suggesting that that data should be available before you draft the complaint, because otherwise you don't even know how to phrase the complaint itself. You have to prove bad faith, and in order to prove bad faith, you need to know who the party is. And so that's the problem with the current scenario, is that you're basically filing in the dark, right?
Anybody else have any comments on this? Diane, were you going to bring up the talk to this issue or a different one?
Hi, Kurt. I was going to talk to a different one, but I certainly understand what Margie's saying. And if there, for clarity purposes, there may be a need to add an additional component to the processing activities, because if we think about from a technological standpoint, even if certain information is redacted, there should be the possibility of being able to have, considering that this is an ICANN purpose, the ability to forward think and get that information, particularly since the fact that either post or pre or post filing is information that's required, needed, and also there is a need for that, and the complainant has the support of this purpose to be able to get that information, even if the system changes from the temporary spec. We have to think forward on how that could be possible. But I'll go back to comment on something else at a different time, but that's my thought on this issue.
All right. Thanks for your forbearance. I kind of think if it's pre-filing, there is no dispute going on, so purpose M doesn't apply. So it seems like it would just be a purpose B inquiry. Benedict, did you want to talk to this issue?
Yeah, I was just, again, I'm really struggling to get my head around this. Margie, perhaps you could speak to this, or if anybody else want to jump in. Who do you envisage as being the processor if these two procedures go into this purpose? So is it just a dispute resolution provider as per the PA4 and PA5, or do you see there being other parties involved? Thank you.
Sure, this is Mark. Yeah, if I could reply. It's both the UDRP provider and the registrar. So if you submit a, basically, you know, if you're trying to seek the data so you can build your case to file your UDRP. And then in the instance that you may not have, so in the privacy proxy scenario that Caitlin described, then that data would come from the UDRP provider generally. But before the filing, if you think about it, the complainant needs to be able to determine whether they should file a UDRP, and they don't know the data until they've asked for it and received the information, and then they have to pay a fee in order to file the complaint. And typically, in the past, we used to include multiple domain names because of, you know, to minimize fees, obviously. What's happening now since May 25th is that the number of domain names being included in a UDRP has gone down, and that's because we don't have the visibility into who's behind the domain name. And so that's essentially what we're talking about. It's approximately 10% down in the numbers of domain names that are involved in a complaint. And so waiting until after the UDRP, after you filed, actually doesn't make sense, because you may not even want to file if you know, for example, that somebody has a competing right in another geography, for example. You may choose to not file your UDRP if you understand that the other party, the registrant, has legitimate rights in the name. And so this is a way of preventing frivolous UDRP filings if you have the ability to do the investigation before you file.
Christina, do you want to talk to this issue?
Sure. I mean, from where I sit, I think there are kind of competing concerns that I am going to suggest that Margie and others who have a similar view try and propose a way to reconcile them. You know, because on the one hand, the idea that a potential complainant could go to a registrar or registry and say, hey, I think I might want to file a PDDRP against this particular registry, but I need to see all the underlying registration data to be sure. I mean, that, quite frankly, aside from the fishing expedition aspects to it, it will be impossible for the party holding that data to undergo, to complete the necessary analysis, because there simply aren't enough facts. On the other hand, you know, if the idea for the PDDRP is that there needs to be this mechanism in place for trademark owners who believe that the registry operator is engaging in that kind of behavior, you know, there that certainly is more difficult to do. What I would suggest, and I'm speaking just personally, not on behalf of the registries, we haven't talked about this yet, but it seems to me that it's incumbent on Margie and others who have a similar view that if they want to go down this road of talking about access, which I kind of have issues with here anyway, I think they need to really put forward a proposal that would put a sufficient obligation and burden on the potential complainant so that the parties from whom the data is being requested are able to actually conduct the analysis that's required under GDPR and similar data protection legislation.
Thanks, Christina. I also would just note that I think
Caitlin's point about how UDRP proceedings with regard to proxies were handled pre-May 25 is a really excellent one.
So Margie, maybe for me, I'm still trying to distinguish your request from purpose B. So is there a different because it seems like the legal basis would be the same, so the test would be the same. So I wonder if you could think about how you would distinguish it from purpose B, so we'd have something to hang our hat on.
Sure. If I may jump in. And actually, I think maybe to address Christina's concern, I'm not thinking about this. I was focused on the UDRP. I wasn't focused on the RDDS, because I appreciate your concern that it could seem like a fishing expedition, and that's not what I was thinking about. So in the context of the UDRP, which is more specific and narrow, right, and the complainant has to have trademark rights in order to be able to even bring the UDRP. So I think that's distinguishable. But I do think that we could certainly take it back and come back to, you know, the group, because I do understand Christina's concern that we don't want to have it be abused, right? So why don't we go ahead and do that, take it back, and maybe circulate something on the list to be discussed at a, you know, future call, so we don't take up more time on this.
Thanks, Margie. James, did you want to talk to this issue or a different one?
Hi, Kurt. James speaking. I actually did want to speak to this issue, but since Margie said she was going to put some language out on the list, I'll lower my hand for now. Thanks.
Okay, great. And Diane, you had your hand up on a different issue before.
Hi, Kurt.
Excuse me?
Oh, hi, Kurt. I was just going to say that, in fact, I think to at least within this purpose address Margie's point that there could be under the processing activity section, for clarity purposes, would be additional language added to have the disclosure column. Post-filing, there would be the ability to have disclosure as needed. I think that could at least partially address this issue.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe if we refer to the provider rules, I think that's right. Cavus, were you trying to get into
yes,
the queue?
I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm an audio grid. I don't know who is in the queue. I had just one small question or comment about the C and purpose F. The language is exactly the same. Is there any reason the language should be the same, purpose C and purpose F? Word by word, comma by comma, and letter by letter, exactly the same. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know. Can anybody on the staff, on the support team, talk to that? I don't have those in front of me. Purposes C and F, which are? The tech content. Go ahead. Yeah.
Kurt, this is Marika. I think I spotted actually the issue yesterday. I think Cavus is probably referring to the roles and responsibilities document. I think there was a copy and paste issue, and indeed the language for, I think, F, the purpose definition, refers to C. So we can fix and update that, but I don't think it has anything to do with what's up on the screen at the moment. It's
right.
It's a different document.
Okay. So thanks for that, Cavus. We've got that, and we'll make that correction. So can the support team sort of clean this up? We'll retain the red line version, but create a clean version and put this in the catalog. We'll make a note somewhere of the material that Margie is going to provide, so we can discuss that later. I'll take that as a yes. Are there any other comments about this purpose M? Caitlin says, yes, we can do that, and gave me a smiley face. Okay, cool. Let's go to purpose N as in Nancy. Christina, do you feel up to talking some more?
Yeah, sure, why not? So here's purpose N, which I have in front of me in hard copy, so that's what I'm going to go from because my eyes are not good enough to read that. In any event, so this is the purpose that we had talked about, the kind of initially identified as the registry operator purpose, and I will get to in a minute kind of whether some of the questions that were posed in the agenda, which I'm trying to pull up. But basically, under the purpose rationale, one of the initial points was that, although it's not in the current rationale version, is that it would be lawful under 61B for registrars and 61F for registries. And I would suggest, if you haven't taken a look at the lawfulness of processing section, that everyone do that, because it's extraordinarily kind of complicated depending upon whether it's a voluntary
eligibility criteria or whether it's something that flows from the registry operator's contract. In the interest of making it kind of easier for everybody, I'll just go through the document in terms of on the screen. The registry agreements allow registry operators to establish, publish, and adhere to clear registration policies, and those are covered through specifications 11 through 13 within the registry agreements. There's also relevant text and authority in ICANN's bylaws under Article 1.1, A1, and Annex G2. And the purpose is not in violation of ICANN's bylaws, because it's consistent with ICANN's mission of coordinating the development and implementation of policies concerning the registration of second-level domain names in gTLDs and principles for allocation of registered names in a TLD. And that latter part is covered by Annex G2. In terms of are there any picket fence considerations, we need to obviously flesh this out a little bit, but it's clearly within the scope of the picket fence that's not an issue there. I have control. How fun. Can we make this bigger? And I guess it would be helpful to see in the chat if folks want me to walk through all of these lawfulness of processing tests or not. But I think the one point that I know that Amr had raised is whether or not registry operators believe that it's necessary that they be able to include the data that is being collected and validated. Yes, Amr, I see your hand. Being collected and validated for purposes of establishing registered name holder satisfaction of those policies, to actually include that in the RDDS. So I put out an email to both the RAND registry group as well as to the registry stakeholder group. And the view of, particularly in the RAND registry group, was that to the extent that it is important for customer trust to be able to have some signal that the registrant is, in fact, if it's obviously not the registry operator or its affiliate, that, is it a trademark licensee, which is covered by Spec 13, that there's value in that. And I got a similar response from the registry operators who responded to my question to the registry stakeholder group list. And in particular, some of the folks who felt most strongly about it were the folks associated with I forget what the name of it is, but the TLDs that, for example, FTLD, they wanted to be able to include in the RDDS, although obviously redacted depending upon what it is, to essentially include the registered name holders, whatever factor it was, whatever the compliance element was, and similarly with the GOs. So I hope that helps. Let me look at the question. I think at this point I'm just going to open it for questions unless folks want me to walk through the lawfulness of processing, which, as I said before, is a little complex. So I'm happy to do that. But Amr?
Thanks, Christina. This is Amr. thanks for the explanation. I was looking forward to hearing back from the registry stakeholder group on why they believe this data needs to be included in the RDDS. Because as we discussed before, I'm not disputing registry operators' need to collect and process this data. I'm not clear on why it needs to be included in the RDDS. And to be honest, the explanations that you've offered don't really sit. They don't really satisfy my, for lack of a better word, curiosity around this purpose. As you mentioned, it's very likely that this data will be redacted to begin with, So I don't see how customers would have access to it in order to get the kind of trust that you've described. And second of all, here the purpose we have in front of us isn't about satisfying customer trust. It's about registry operators being able to validate that the name holder satisfies the registration policy eligibility criteria. So what you're describing is an entirely different purpose altogether, and it involves, you know, disclosure of this data to basically anyone who wants to determine whether he or she can trust a domain name registration or not. So again, this still isn't sitting very well with me. I don't understand why this needs to be included in the registration, in registration data. Again, yes, registries do need to collect and process this data for the purpose that is on the sheet in front of us, which is a validation of the name holder's satisfaction of the criteria. But I still don't see this as a worthy explanation of why it needs to be included in the work that we're doing here. Thank you.
I understand the concern. I mean, I think maybe Amr, another way to think about it is, you know, to allow the registry operator to demonstrate, and you know, I'm mindful of kind of the legal versus natural person distinction, some of those issues that we've talked about. But, you know, for example, for Spec 13, in many cases, the trademark licensee is going to be a legal person. Similarly, for example, you know, natural persons can't be registrants in .bank and in .and insurance, as far as I know. So it's really allowing the registry operator to be transparent and accountable, to kind of publicly demonstrate that they are collecting this data, that they are what they're holding themselves out to be.
Christina, this is Amr again. Yeah, I think there are other ways that registry operators can demonstrate that they're accountable and transparent without adding data elements to the RDDS and allowing them to be disclosed under certain circumstances that are still not clear in this purpose. So the whole thing is just kind of vague to me. I don't see how it would work or why it would need to work at all to be able to get what you want done. So, I think there are lots of different ways that, you know, registry operators can demonstrate their trustworthiness as well as the trustworthiness of their name holders. But I just don't see this isn't explaining how that would be done through this purpose very well. Thanks.
Okay. I think then in that case, I think I do need some help from you, and we can talk about it more offline because I see there's other hands up. But I do think it's, and I'm trying to find Annex G because it has some relevant language in there. But let's talk about it a little bit more offline and then come back, although I'm happy to if you know, we can talk about it more now. But Milton, I see your hand is up.
Yes, just following up on the last point that Amr raised, I understand and would support any registry with a restricted or policy-based eligibility requirement to collect data for the purposes of dating or enforcing eligibility requirements. What I don't understand is that this has anything whatsoever to do with the public who is. I think, you know, you can ask people at the point of registration whether they're a bank or a doctor, and you can develop whatever mechanism of registration you like for that. But the public who is essentially for people other than the registry to validate things. And unless you're saying that if you run a policy-limited registry or TLD that you want anybody in the world to be able to check whether, you know, your registrants are actually meeting those criteria, which I hope you're not asking for, if that involves, of course, natural persons, I don't see the point of even including purpose N in the whole who is discussion. It's just a private matter between the registry and the registrant. And if the you know, I guess I just don't, I still don't get it. I think both Amr and I are fundamentally asking the same question, but we're just not getting a, an answer.
Sure. I understand that, and I think I need to get a better understanding of kind of what type of answer Amr is looking for. I would disagree, though, that it's really just between the registry operator and the registrant, because for anything that is a community restriction, something that is covered by a PIC or that would be quote-unquote adopt brand, these are all included in the registry operator's contracts with ICANN. So, you know, I think there's this additional party in there. And to be clear, I'm not saying that it should just be, you know, everybody's data should be out there. But in many cases, we are talking about, we are talking about registries where you can only have a legal person as a registrant. So, you know, I think what I'm trying to do here is to kind of find a balance that doesn't add more into the policy recommendations that we need, but that will also at the same time kind of continue to allow the registry operators that, for example, are using registration eligibility policies to try and innovate within their TLDs to do so. And I think one of the, you know, the concerns that we have is that I think at a minimum we need to be able to go out to public comment, and I would be totally fine. And frankly, I think it would be super helpful to include in the initial report a specific question on, you know, should registry operators that have these criteria, many of them want to be able to include the data elements that demonstrate the eligibility in RDDS. Do you agree or disagree? I mean, I think getting the input on that would be extraordinarily helpful.
Let's go to Alan's question, and then I have a comment.
Yeah, sorry, Alan. I saw the A, and I misread it as Amr. I'm going to blame it on my new glasses. Sorry.
Thank you. Look, we could take this information out of WHOIS and build a whole new display mechanism for this kind of thing. I don't think that's our job here. Right now, the information is included within the contracts. It is within WHOIS, within the RDS specification. It is needed by compliance. And Amr may be right. Maybe we need a new purpose or need to change the wording of this to encompass the consumer trust and the other verification needs that other entities may have or the registries may want them to have. But short of building a whole new structure to make this information available, I think we need to cover it here. It exists today. It is being used. The registries want it and believe it is a necessary part of having their registry be viable. So I believe we and since you know, that could just be a registry need if they publish it in some other way. But since it is being done with contractual clauses and requirements in the various specifications, registrars are involved in it also, and compliance has to be able to act on it if they're not following their own rules. I think it's a no-brainer that it is part of RDS WHOIS, and we just need to word this properly to cover that. Thank you.
Milton, go ahead.
So, Milton Mueller here. Christina said something about most of the registries that she's talking about are not talking about natural persons. Was that correct?
Many of them are not, but I don't want to. I know that, for example, you know, .nyc allows natural persons to be registrants, and .nyc is one that currently they amended their registry agreement so that they can include in RDDS a field relating to the nexus with the registration eligibility policy.
Yeah, but in that case, all we're talking about is location, residence, and so that's already included in the WHOIS collection, and it's fairly easy to authenticate. So I really think if we're just talking legal persons here, then we're not going to be so concerned. But when you're talking about this broader sweep on what information you can collect to validate the eligibility of a registered name holder, again, if that's between the registry and the registrant and ICANN compliance as a private matter, it's okay. But when we have people talking about consumer trust and about it sounds like you're talking about anybody in the world being able to query this and get the eligibility, that's when we're getting concerned. You're talking about a major expansion both of ICANN's mission and of the nature of the WHOIS data elements. It could include almost anything about anybody. So we don't like that, and we're not going to support Purpose N as long as these things are not cleared up in a way that is consistent with privacy values.
Milton, it's Christina. You know, just to clarify, these registries are not limiting registration to just legal persons. Many of the registry operators that responded to my specific query about why they think it's necessary to be able to include, you know, some validation element in their RGDS do limit their registrations to natural persons, but obviously not all of them do. So I apologize if I misspoke. I think at this point, you know, Amr's asked the question twice. I've gone back to the registry stakeholder group twice. I think it would be really helpful at this point to, you know, maybe Amr and I set up a time to kind of work together online to figure out exactly what information that I can get that will address his questions, because I don't at this point seem to be getting that. You know, at this point, I feel like I'm just kind of throwing arrows at the dartboard, and I don't think that's a good use of anyone's time.
Okay, thanks, Christina. So that was a good explanation, a really good discussion. I have a couple observations. One is maybe flesh out the purpose a little bit, you know, enabling validation of registered name holder satisfaction, blah, blah, and then maybe in order two. So maybe some more detail could be provided to the purpose. Two is that there's certainly the registries in certain cases are certainly going to be collecting personal information in certain cases. So wherever the data resides, handling that data has to be in accordance with GDPR. Third is I don't think this purpose contemplates disclosure of data to others outside the registrar. I know it says disclosure of and a couple of blanks here, but you know, I think that might only be to ICANN compliance, if anyone. So I think we should kind of blatantly address Milton's concern that the idea here is to enable the validation of the registered name holder satisfaction of the registration requirements and not much else as far as disclosure goes. So I think you should address that blatantly. And then finally, you know, whether it belongs here or not, you know, I think that's the discussion with Amr. You know, for me, if it's to this group, if it's a registry purpose and not an ICANN purpose, then it's just between the registry, the registrar, and the registrant, and doesn't need to be in a consensus policy. But, you know, if it's in compliance with an ICANN contract and the whole communication among, registry, registrar, and ICANN is in compliance with ICANN, you know, that sort of lifts it into the realm where it does belong here. So I think that's those are the two discussions you might have with Amr's amenable to this is, you know, maybe a little more definition around the registry purpose, you know, limiting the disclosure of data, and then, you know, what's the hook that, you know, how does this belong in an ICANN consensus policy? Because ICANN's part of this troika. So I think that's, you know, especially that last thing is what you have to settle. Does that make sense, or did I go on for too long? Yeah, I went on for too long. Christina, are you there?
Sorry, they're moving somebody into the area right outside where I sit, so it's getting kind of loud. No, I thought that was helpful. I do think, you know, I'm more than happy to talk with Milton and Amr about it. It may be that we need to reword it in such a way that addresses their concerns and makes it clearer why this should be, you know, part of the consensus policy, and I'm certainly happy to do that.
Great, thanks. And do it fast. I'm just looking at the chat. Okay, so so that's good. So I'm ready to move on to the close of the meeting unless anybody has any more comments about this. Okay, can Caitlin or Marika, do we have action items coming out of this?
Yes, Kurt, this is Marika. I have a couple listed. Let me just scroll down my own notes. So the first one is in relation to purpose M, and Margie to provide further details in relation to potential disclosure to complainant in relation to possible UDRP filing. And the second action item for staff to produce an updated clean version for Purpose M for EPDP team review based on today's discussion and the input that has been provided by Christina and Diane. And then in relation to our last discussion, Christina to connect with Milton and Amr to see how concerns can be addressed for Purpose N and suggest updates accordingly. And then, of course, coming back to our initial discussion, there are, of course, a bunch of outstanding action items that you know, hopefully everyone will be able to complete as soon as possible as well.
Thanks for that, Marika. We're going to work on meeting planning for the next face-to-face. Alan, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. I've mentioned a couple of times the Kobe meeting. The ICANN travel lists have to be in within a week or so. So if we are not going to act on it, that implies we will not be having a plenary face-to-face meeting in Kobe, where a lot of our members will be there in any case. So I just want confirmation that that is indeed the plan. Otherwise, we're going to be in a situation where some people are at the meeting and many will not be at the meeting. Given that
thanks
it's in March,
that,
it seems to be an appropriate time when we should be meeting if we can do it at a reasonable cost.
Right. So the plan, there's no funding for the COBE meeting, and the plan is not to meet there. So if that changes, well, some other accommodation to the timing of filing for travel support will have to be made.
Okay.
That's what I'm...
Kurt, this is Rick. If I can just... sorry to interrupt. If I could just add to that, you know, just because there's no support doesn't necessarily mean the group won't meet. It may just meet like other PDP working groups do, you know, with those in attendance participating on the ground, others participating remotely. So one doesn't necessarily exclude the other.
Thanks, Mirka. And there's one other really important administrative note that I want to make, and that is that time is changing for some of us, but not all of us, this weekend. And so I would prefer that we move the meeting an hour to 1400 UTC, which is, you know, so it'll remain the same for those of us on daylight savings time, but be an hour later for those that are not on daylight savings time. And if anybody from the Southern Hemisphere is on the phone, I apologize for that, and it's the reverse of that. But we'll make that clear in a meeting notice for the meetings that start next week. All right, so everybody agrees with me. That's a first, huh? All right, so thanks very much for the constructive discussion. We'll get on the action items that we have, and we'll talk to you on email, I'm sure, over the next 48 hours and then in the meeting on Thursday. So thanks very much and have a great day.
Thank you, everybody. This concludes today's call. Operator, you may now stop the recording and the deadline. Have a great rest of your days. Goodbye.